Number six, presentation and recommendation from Mr. Veras, also known as Hoffman.
That's going to live with me for a while, isn't it?
Easy to remember.
That's starting to stick. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I think you have some materials in front of you. We're covering a couple items on the agenda. So the first presentation is slightly labeled Meeting Materials.
Nice title.
For item six. In page two, we have a couple of session objectives here, I guess four in total. So review the asset allocation decisions with the 2016 capital market assumption. So this just ties back to when we originally did the FFP model with you in December. We said that we'll come back to you every year based on our updated capital market assumptions and take a look at how those might change the portfolio, see if that causes us to change any allocations or any tweaking we might want to do. So that's what this session generally is. And then the second bullet point here is we've talked a lot about risk diversifying strategies. We've kind of used that term, but we never really talked about what's that mean. What are we actually investing in when we use risk diversifying strategies? So we're going to start peeling that onion today, too. So we're not going to get to the conclusion, but going to introduce some things. Third bullet point, identify some key implementation milestones. I think it came up in the discussion this morning that we're not going to get to FFP tomorrow. And so in terms of setting it up, how are we going to get there and when, and should we set up some intermediate milestones so that we know that we're tracking appropriately? And then finally, revisit Contra Costa's approach to private markets. So we note that we're having a much heavier allocation to private equity than what you've had in the past, and also private credit, introducing that and a heavy allocation there. So because of those two allocations being pretty significant and because of all the evolution going on in the marketplace, this gives us time to revisit our traditional approach and say, is there a better, more cost-effective solution out there than simply the private equity fund-of-funds kind of approach? So we're going to start introducing that topic as well. Okay. Let's start with the first bullet point in terms of taking a look at the asset allocation on page 5. We have the standard eye chart showing the asset allocation today, which is our current policy. 2015 column is the asset allocation that we came out of the December meeting with, so that's the actual numbers. 2016 then is a carbon copy of that, saying, okay, we're going to run that same asset allocation mix through the model using our updated capital market assumptions, so that's why it has its own column. And then portfolios A, B, and C offer three alternatives. And without getting into the details here, the highlighted areas are where the changes are made. So it makes it easy to see we're introducing some concepts that have higher allocation to risk diversifying and risk parity, lower allocations to private equity, private credit, and some tweaks on the margins with some of the other asset allocations. And why do we do that? Well, page 6 shows us some interesting results. Actually, somewhat surprising, I think. For current policy, on page 6 at the top is set up to generate over a 10-year time frame an expected return of 7.1% with a standard deviation of 12. In 2015, the FFP model we selected looked like it would generate 7.2% with a standard deviation of about 11, 10.8. We take that same portfolio, though, and run it through with 2016 assumptions, and the numbers change. So 7.2 becomes a 7.9% return, so noticeably higher there, 0.7%. And standard deviation goes from, well, about the same, 10.8 to 11. So that's roughly equivalent. But this captured our attention because 7.9 is higher than what we probably necessarily need to target, probably particularly coming out of this morning's session. So we took a look at three alternatives, which allow us to generate a 7.5, 7.6 kind of return with same or lower risk. And that's really how these portfolios were constructed. Portfolio A dials down risk a little bit, 10.3. Portfolios B and C dial it down more, 9.8 and 9.6. So we wanted to highlight these because they do have some changes. And if you're able to have 5 and 6 open at the same time, I guess that'd be most convenient. If not, just I can tell you that portfolio B takes our allocation to emerging markets down. So we have a 14% allocation in our current target. That would bring it down to 10. Given some of the volatility in emerging markets, that might be something we are interested in doing. We also increased the allocation to U.S. Treasuries from what we had at 2%, doubling it in Portfolio A to 4, or 3% in Portfolios B and C. Real estate, we would get out of core real estate entirely now and have our real estate exposures only in value add and opportunistic, 4% each. And keeping 1% in REITs, mainly as a sort of funding strategy, because the liquidity of the value add and opportunistic is quarterly at best with long queues. We can use REITs as a way to get exposure there short term. Risk diversifying strategies, which we'll talk about soon, increases along with the introduction of risk parity. So in Portfolio A, we're showing 5% to risk parity and 4% to risk diversifying. Portfolio B has it all in risk diversifying, and Portfolio C has another 4 and 5% split. And then private equity and private credit. Previously, we had 34% of the portfolio allocated to these two classes. Now we can dial that down to 23 or 28% with Portfolios A at 23 and Portfolios B and C at 28. So that allows us to provide higher liquidity to the portfolio as well. So these are pretty favorable results. I mean, pretty good stuff. Lower risk, similar return expectations, lower liquidity issues. Some good things here to consider. Page 7 shows some stress tests. Page 8 starts getting into the historical scenarios. And we can see here, as we take a look through page 8, all of the portfolios have a better downside exposure, downside risk exposure, than our current FFP 4-year. So A, B, and C all have less drawdown if we were to go through 2008 again, less if we went through 2001.com slowdown again. And then differing results on the upside. So we would have less upside in the 2009 recovery and less, or depending, somewhat equal in this 97 to 99 oil price decline. And then the results on page 9, we have the U.S. rate hike. We do better there, less on the upside with the European currency crisis. And a similar story for the other three downside scenarios. So at this point, we don't have on the agenda that we're asking for any specific approval of A, B, or C. We're showing you what these options have. And as we continue to migrate the portfolio, this isn't going to matter in the course of the next month or so. Anyhow, we can sync this up with the adoption of the investment policy statement and having the asset allocation reflected in there as well. But let me just pause and see if there are any questions on what we're looking at.
Given what Siegel used as the expected return, were they using this 7.9 as their expected return in their portfolio?
No.
Okay. Well, adjusted for inflation, but that's not the number they were using.
My understanding is their work included our 2015 capital market assumptions, not the 2016, and then they had the survey of the other consulting firms, and I don't know what data they provided.
Actually, I thought that they, because in their breakdown, they showed private credit and various other items that we don't currently have in our portfolio, so I was assuming that they were using,
using
the full implementation of the FFP.
That they are. Yes, they're using the asset allocation mix that you see on page 5.
Which?
For 2015 column.
So by going to one of these other portfolios, either A, B, or C, that's going to bring down that expected return.
Explain it.
That they used in their presentation today. So let's see.
I guess the question would be, certainly the weights could potentially be changing.
Right.
The question is, were they operating off the 2016 capital market assumptions or the 2015 capital market assumptions? I don't know if that's just the truth.
My understanding is that they were using a long-term projection of capital market assumptions, not just 1 year ago, right?
But from what point looking forward 10 years?
Okay.
And the reason this is kind of probably looks like a shocking difference is your last year was a significant drawdown, and basically your starting point starts from a lower point. Long term, you expect it to the same place. Your long term, you expect the returns go up. And so we're taking a look at this and saying, you know, remember we said to you all, let's really dial in the liquidity portion, let's dial in that 48 months of benefit payment set aside, and then on the growth and diversify, and take an annual look at potentially refreshing where the highest and best use of our dollars are there. So this is the first iteration of that exercise of where is the highest and best use of our growth and diversifying dollars. And Varys is kind of mapping out a couple of potential iterations here. It's not meant to, Brian, to your point, it's not meant to reinvent the wheel. It's saying, are there tweaks in the growth and in the diversifying bucket that are prudent to make at this point in time given where valuations
are? I guess my question was their expected return for each of these various mixes or portfolios or allocations, are they significantly different from the assumption that Siegel was using in their valuation?
So my quick review of their materials looks like they used our 2015 asset allocation that we show on page 5. They used return assumptions, standard deviation and correlations that are either ours or remarkably similar, because they're getting to a 7.25%, and we have 7.2 on this page. So we're certainly within the range of precision of any of this modeling.
So they're using in their 5.19 real rate of return our current portfolio. Is that what you're saying?
Your current target portfolio.
Our current allocation.
That's right.
So they did not include in their 5.19 our FFP allocation or projected FFP allocation and projected return.
No, that's exactly what they included. They included FFP.
They did the target allocation, not the current allocation.
They did the target allocation for FFP.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. I think that question did come up.
Okay. Yeah. Got it.
Okay. Any other questions of Ed so far?
Okay. Then let's move forward to section 2, which starts on page 10. Page 10 is the placeholder. Page 11 is the actual text. So risk diversifying strategies, and we talked about this in the construction of FFP as being the third component to it, that we have the liquidity component, we know those benefit and expenses in 4 years. We have the growth component because we want to grow the plan's assets over time. But if you just invested in growth assets, you'd experience a lot of volatility. And so maybe we can dial down that volatility by having exposure to risk diversifying strategies. So on page 11, we highlight that you already do have some things like this in your portfolio with AFL-CIO, PIMCO All Asset, and Wellington Real Return. These are assets strategies that are designed to behave differently than your growth portfolio. They're designed to have low correlation. That's the key. We're looking for strategies that have low correlation to equities principally. And so when we're looking across all the asset classes, when we look at the correlation matrix and we say, what behaves differently here? These are the things we can find. And they come to us in different forms and different formats. So PIMCO All Asset is a great example. That's sort of PIMCO's ability to allocate across commodities and REITs and fixed income and alternatives. Wellington, similarly, it's allocating across equities, commodities, currencies, risk management, and active exposures. So those things all do behave differently. And it's a little bit tough sometimes because when you have exposure to commodities, for example, and you watch commodities collapse and you say, my gosh, why did I have any exposure to it? It's actually behaving the way it's supposed to. We don't necessarily feel that we wanted that because we watched an asset decline in value, and aren't we trying to increase in value? Yes. But because the rest of our portfolio has been going up during that time period, to have that one offset was natural and intent on the portfolio construction. Maybe not as much as we want. And so we have to think about how to smartly get commodity exposures. That's just one example. So turning ahead then, we're providing you with the hedge fund environment that we created in November. And hedge fund is an odd way of describing this, because hedge funds is really more of a product design than an investment strategy. But they are, as an industry, loosely referred to as hedge funds. And so we provide some introductory materials about it. And our general view on hedge funds is that it hasn't been a very favorable place to invest over the past 5 years or so. And in fact, when hedge funds first came on the scene, they were a very favorable place to invest. But they were really expensive. There were very few managers. And you had to get a lot of comfort with the managers doing what they were saying they're doing, and they're running their shops appropriately. The industry has evolved over time, and so the original promise of we can deliver equity-like returns with bond-like volatility because we're using hedging strategies sounded great, but what we've seen in the last few years is that's not true, that we have seen very high correlation to equity strategies, so you're giving me volatility like the equities. You're giving me corrections like the equities, so you're not helping me out there. So overall, all you're doing is getting me equity-like exposure with really high fees. I'm not interested. So we've taken a pretty critical view of this and said, okay, maybe that's not fair. Broad brush, there's probably something there. When you look at the combined indices, there's something there that supports that. But when you tear apart those indices and you say, okay, show me the top managers. Show me which ones have been good at doing this. Show me which ones have earned their fees. There are specific strategies and specific managers that do that. So how do you find them? That's a challenge. There are tens of thousands of hedge funds out there, and they're not easy to find. And like I said, operational due diligence is really a key, because when you're looking at these shops and you're saying, how do I know I'm not getting into a Madoff kind of situation, you got to go and meet them. You got to go through a lot more accounting kind of operational due diligence than what we've had to do with our typical long-only investment strategies. So.
You got to take the elevator down to the 17th floor. Check that out, too.
There you go. So what we've done is we've taken a different approach to it, we being Verus, and we've looked at it and said, you know, if we tried to hire a few people to look at this, it wouldn't be sufficient. We wouldn't be able to canvas the universe very well, and we wouldn't be able to get in the shops and do the due diligence we need to. So we decided to partner with Axia. And I think we talked to you about that before when you first hired us, that Axia is a partnership, and Axia has 100 people dedicated to doing this kind of thing. And they have been doing it for much longer and have had good results. And they're a specialty consultant. I mean, you could hire Axia if you wanted to just for hedge fund exposure. For us and for bringing it to our clients, we have partnered with them. So I just want to be clear on that, that that relationship is something that we can bring to clients. It's a different arrangement. So it's helped us better understand the environment. And so what we show then on the next several pages are some of this high-level view of these strategies. The first is alternative beta. And alternative beta is an approach that some hedge funds are using to say, if I take a look at what's going on in the hedge fund space, I can figure it out, and I don't need to be spending all my time doing research. I can almost take an indexed kind of approach to it. And if I construct my portfolio smartly, I can do it for a very low cost. And I can still have my strategies behave the way the hedge fund managers that I'm looking at do, but I can do it on a more liquid basis and more effectively, and I can get better risk management characteristics out of it because I'm using more of a quantitative model to do it. So alternative beta is an interesting way that offers plans a lower correlation, which we were talking about, lower fees, which we talked about, and higher liquidity. So this is one area that we think is interesting and maybe something for future consideration. On page 21, we highlight event-driven. These are strategies that you see, and with all of these pages, the top one or maybe even two lines pretty much describe what the strategy is. But the event-driven is looking for events like a merger and acquisition and saying, when I see a merger announced, there tends to be a discrepancy between what the price of the stock of the firm being acquired is and what the offering price is from the acquirer. And because of that, there's a risk associated with whether the deal closes or not. If the deal finally closes, the value of that acquired firm's stock will go up to the purchasing price of the parent who's buying them. If the deal falls apart, that delta will never be recognized. So that stock will probably fall or do something different, or maybe it has another suitor or something else. But it won't close the gap. And so event-driven hedge fund managers look at those opportunities and say, aha, here's something going on, I can play that, and I can try to capture that. And I know that most acquisitions are going to go through. Or I've done the research on these two particular companies, and I think the probabilities are higher than what the market thinks, or lower than what the market thinks. And so they can play things like that. But that's event-driven. Lately, we haven't been terribly constructive on event-driven strategies. Part of it is we just haven't found many good ones, and part of it is just the characteristics in the market, which you see in the lower right-hand side. The number of failed deals has really ticked up pretty dramatically.
Yeah, the first two on the list, Allergan recently didn't go through.
Right.
Right.
And then Valiant.
Good luck.
It actually shows a 72% year-to-date return, but I think the next day is when.
Timing is important.
That's right. So much of the M&A activity seems to be today more chatter than reality. You know, so it's got to be a pretty critical thing to be looking at some of these things, especially with an eye towards antitrust. Potential antitrust ramifications, because a lot of these things are falling apart.
Antitrust and the tax inversion play.
Tax inversion.
The U.S. company buying the foreign company to get the shelter, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Williams has been a disaster, even though it shows 19%.
Yeah. Time Warner was in the news recently with
right.
that.
It just got approved.
But those have, the article, at least that I read, said the conditions on that were rather extraordinary.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in terms of what Justice was able to get,
okay.
or is demanding, you know, requiring outreach to 2 million additional households, literally forcing one of the two into a non-traditional invasion of a geographic market. forcing competition, making you go out and serve 2 million homes you don't now, which means I have to take on someone else's turf.
Right.
It's an interesting condition in a
lot of new non-underwritable loans.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've seen this story. It doesn't work out well.
I don't know how it's going to work, but yeah, it's like
CDOs are next.
So I think you're probably in agreement that we're not very constructive on this space.
These are some tough ones to call.
Page 22 is highlighting long-short equity strategies. I always thought this one was interesting. This one just makes sense to me in terms of when you hear the managers come in and talk about the business case for a stock and why they invested and they were so smart and they got it right and yada, 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 and now it's, you know, a great performer in their portfolio. You got to figure they're doing some research that leads them to believe this one is a sell candidate. This company is highly overvalued. But most of our long-only strategies only have the bandwidth or the permission within their investment guidelines to take that long position. They can't do anything on the short side. This is different. This says, okay, so if we're doing all that research, let us take short positions. And so we tend to like certain managers here. Tends to be managers of managers where we have multiple strategies coming together, either within the same house or a multi-manager approach. But there are some good ones here. We also like that some of the quantitative strategies allow for the management of market and factor risk exposures, so it can be contained, which is important. So we look at the book and whether it's incredibly long or incredibly short and how they're playing that market. The idea in calling it a hedge fund is that I can take long positions and I can take short positions, and my net exposure to the market can be zero. It can be plus or minus, but I can actually hedge it out to zero, which is kind of the very, you know, epitome of what a hedge fund is doing, hedging out the market risk. I can take that away, and then I only have exposure to these individual calls. So kind of interesting things there. 23 is CTA, an acronym we choose not to define, so we send a consultant out to tell you what it means. It's a commodity trading advisor. So the commodity trading advisors and global macro tend to be trend following strategies, and if they're just trend following and CTA and high volatility or high turnover strategies, we don't really see much value there. Why pay the extra fees for a quant model? Global macro can be interesting, particularly if they're small and nimble, particularly if they can work in the emerging markets effectively. They can get some incremental returns there if they're right about their calls. And so there are some interesting strategies there in global macro. So those are a couple ideas for the future. And then the last one is relative value. So relative value is basically looking for opportunities between securities, however they might be paired. One easy way to think about it is the same company out there has stock and bonds and convertible bonds, and those convertible bonds, if they convert into equity, are worth this much. You can run the math and figure out whether they're better off converting or not, and then play the value of the stock against the convertible bonds and trade those. Creates many arbitrage opportunities. And so that's what relative value is trying to identify those. So there are some interesting ones here as well, some pluses and minuses, but they can be used effectively. And then the last couple pages, just a summary of our views. And we do this annually, so presumably we'll have a November 2016 view on the markets, but then I think in between now and then we'll be providing some more research in terms of how we think it could work in the portfolio. Turning to section three, we take a look at risk parity. So risk parity, we don't categorize as a hedge fund. They don't organize themselves as such. So these are more like the commingled trusts, even mutual fund packages that you're used to seeing. But here, risk parity on page 29 highlights a couple interesting things. And what we see out of these managers is that they've now been around long enough. So we're starting to bring them to clients, 10-year track records kind of thing, significant asset base, stable personnel, consistent application of their approach, which we like. So now that they're meeting these kind of thresholds and introducing them, the risk parity idea is in itself is pretty novel and very much consistent with how we think of managing risk in a portfolio. You'll see some charts in here that are similar to those. We'll get to those in a minute. What they do is they invest in equities, publicly traded equities, fixed income, and commodities. And principally, that's how they're creating their mix. And because it's an active management of the commodities exposure, we like that because commodities can be quite volatile. And so page 30 then highlights the difference. And the risk parity approach to portfolio construction introduces leverage. And the leverage, interestingly enough, is applied to the fixed income portfolio. And so we take a look at how they get equity exposure. They can pretty much just buy stocks, but they don't need to leverage that up. They need to leverage up fixed income. And if you think about why leveraging up fixed income makes sense, first let's take a look at page 31. So here is the capital allocation of a traditional, call it a 60-40 portfolio, 55% in equities, 35% in fixed, and 10% in real assets. A typical pension plan at a high level. But what we find with that is the risk allocation is dominated by that equity exposure. Because your equities go up and down so much, that's generating all the volatility, and that's why it's 85%. Fixed income, pretty stable, hardly moves much at all, and then real assets contribute some. And so the traditional approach is that. Page 32, though, is the risk parity approach. So through the use of leverage, we essentially create a 44% allocation to equity, or 40, 160% to fixed income, and 40% to real assets. And we have to do it that way, or risk parity managers have to do it that way, to create the right-hand side, the risk allocation, so that you're getting equal contributions of volatility from your equity portfolio and from your fixed income portfolio. So why would we do that? So you think back to 2008, and you have the equity markets collapse 30%, and you watch the treasury markets do really well, and you say, I'm glad I had something in treasuries. That helped me out. Chances are you had a lot more exposure to the equity side than to the fixed income side. And because the fixed income only moved up a few percentage points while equities collapsed by tens of percentage points, you really needed to have a whole lot more fixed income exposure to offset your loss in the equities. And that's what they're doing. They're looking at it and saying, if I really want to get it, I need to go 166% treasuries. So to do that, they invest in treasury futures. So if I need $100,000 of exposure to treasuries, I don't go out and buy $100,000 worth of treasury bonds. Instead, I buy a futures contract that's worth, has a face value of $100,000 that'll settle in some number of months forward. But to get that, I only need to put on $2,000. I only need to buy a future for $2,000. So there's some education in terms of how the futures market work, actually. We have Brian here, so if we need to get into futures detail, I know I have an expert at the table, remembering from last time. But it's that very trait. So now, with a futures contract, there is the conclusion of the contract when you take delivery. They don't do that. They sell out of the contract, create an offsetting contract so that they don't have to do that, and they continue to roll their exposure forward. The other interesting thing here is to do this portfolio, they have daily monitoring of what's going on in the markets. So there are measures of volatility, kind of like what we bring to you with an annual assessment of volatility for each asset class. They have those being updated through their computers daily. And so they take a look at those constantly, and they look at changes in volatility in the marketplace and adjust the portfolio, typically monthly. So a little bit higher turnover, a little bit more flexibility than what we have today built into our governance model, really. So their governance model is designed to do that. So some pretty interesting characteristics. Let me pause there, see if there are any questions. That was kind of a lot to digest.
Ed, I just wanted to ask you about, there are two of the more common criticisms of risk parity is that you have to have a decent amount of leverage, as you mentioned, to really make it effective, as well as a concern that it's a newer strategy. Like you said, we finally have some 10-year returns to look at. Compared to some of our other, most of other strategies have a much longer history and have, you know, been stress tested and had those market, you know, a number of market events, you know, see what really happens with it. What do you feel are some of the ways that investors can get comfortable with being in this space?
So the 10-year track record is pretty good because it captures 2008, and the design of these models is to protect on the downside. What's a better test than 2008? So that's a good litmus test. We like the history because when we're looking at a manager and a strategy and we're getting to know the people, we're getting to know their process and all of that good stuff and get an idea of how it's supposed to behave, this one's pretty transparent. They're pretty open about what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, when we're going to make these decisions, and then take a look and see if we've done what we said we would do. And they've been consistent about that. So it's not like something that we would feel like we have low transparency and I really need a long track record to believe you. It's like you're doing what you said you'd do, you have a good track record of doing that, and the results have been what consistent with what we would expect. So that's all. It all seems to jive. It's consistent. It's internally coherent. Would be a better way of describing it.
Harvey?
Would we need to reserve against the futures liability contingency?
Good question. No. The managers do that. So whenever they buy into a futures contract, they have a minimum amount that they must have. They hold multiples higher than that for that very reason. A, they don't want to have to deal with daily mark-to-market calls. B, they don't want to have to come back to us with anything embarrassing. So it's part of their risk management approach is to preserve the liquidity in the portfolio.
What do they do with that liquidity?
What do they
do? Do they just sit on that liquidity?
They do.
Doing something with it?
No, they sit on it. So you would think that there's a cash drag to it, and there is, but because the futures is a leveraged exposure, they're getting net-net what they expect to do for the economic returns.
So in this, say, this type of strategy, would we be considered a limited partner in this, where the manager is a GP, and so our exposure is just what funds we have committed to the manager?
Yes. Okay. You probably aren't a limited partner. You're probably an investor in a commingled trust.
Okay. So our exposure is limited just to money that we have invested
right.
in the...
Yeah, that's right.
Jerry? Yeah. Is there any exposure that we have anywhere that is outside of our investment or in excess of our investment?
No.
Okay.
So I
wasn't
guess
aware of any. Okay.
Another way to word that, John, would that in terms of explicit leverage? So we would term this implicit because it's within the portfolio and within the futures that they're taking on, but there's no explicit leverage that they're creating a portfolio and then borrowing against that to invest more. So it's built into the design of the future.
As you know, there are some real estate general partner, limited partner arrangements where there is some potential, at least for the general partner, to go back to the limiteds and ask for money.
Right.
I'm assuming, one, if we have any of those, it's voluntary. You could end up with dilution, but
there's no ability to mandate that.
Right. Just a straight capital call?
Yeah.
Is what they're asking. Yeah. Yeah, okay. But a voluntary capital call?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, in other words, there is no involuntary. No. Right.
You can get watered down. You get diluted.
You can get diluted, but exactly.
Yeah, okay. not with risk parity approaches.
Okay.
And that's also probably a good topic to handle with a specific manager selection and strategy so that we are careful about what the guidelines say. But not
I know, and his due diligence, Tim, would never allow that to take place.
Yeah. Just to step back here as a framing exercise, so Ed, the education we're talking about here, the high-level education on risk parity, what are you looking for board direction on today?
Introducing the topic, again, trying to peel that onion of risk diversifying strategies and doing it in two parts, the hedge fund outlook and going through what are hedge fund strategies that may or may not appeal and give us the kind of exposure we want. And risk parity would be another approach there. Doesn't fall into the hedge fund bucket, but is risk diversifying. So low correlation.
Yeah, I want to frame this in I see three moving pieces here. One, we're looking at an updated set of guidance on the relative split and composition of the growth and diversifying categories. Two, one of the changes here is a potential expansion of what we talked about in the risk diversifying categories. So we're putting some more definition around that. And then the third would be potential implementation of all that ways down the road.
Yes, but a few more pages in this deck, we'll start getting into that. I think one is we're talking about that in terms of the updated asset allocation between growth and risk diversifying. So we would probably need to come back for formal approval on that as we continue to think about it. Okay, let's jump ahead a few pages. Page 39, one of our other bullet points for this session was implementation milestones. So just some high-level progress checkpoints. Establishing the overlay and transition management providers. This part we're working on now. We're coming back to you with the specific searches on each of those. Establish the liquidity strategy. We're working on that. We've conducted the RFI. Have read through the respondents and will currently constructing the RFP that will be going out to a select few of those. Probably about a dozen, I think is our number. Then soon we hope to be transitioning assets, once the first two are taken care of, transitioning assets across the public equity and fixed income strategies to begin migrating the current portfolio. So those are the liquid strategies, things we can do sooner than later. We'll then be thinking about conducting education and searches for new mandates and then identifying holding strategies, meaning that while we're trying to fund private equity or trying to fund private credit or what have you, or real estate strategies, where are we going to keep the capital in the meantime? And so that's a key component. And then as
on
a result...
Excuse me, sorry. On your RFI responses, did you get just as a... more or less than you expected? Were you surprised at the response, or what kind of interest do you think you've gotten?
We got more than 50. I think it was probably 52, 53 responses. That was pretty good.
No, you thought that was pretty good. Okay.
It was everyone you would have expected and a few others. Yeah. So because there were a few others involved, I thought that was good because we like to see what they're interested in pursuing us for, and even though they may not be a major player in the fixed income world, but...
So if you've gotten three responses, you might have thought, wait a minute. Yeah, okay, all right.
Okay. The next page, just to wrap up this section, is the approach to private markets. And so kind of mentioned this earlier, increasing the allocation here to private markets. Introduction of private credit itself is a new asset class. Private credit, while having similarities to private equity in that you're investing in companies that are not publicly traded, how we actually get exposure through the investment managers is a bit different. And then a variety of solutions exist. So there are different models here. One is that we could continue doing basically what we're doing, having staff and your investment advisor work together in terms of identifying using private equity funds of funds pretty extensively and so on. Another approach is to hire a specialty consultant and say, this requires that much attention, and we could probably get away from the private equity fund of funds model because that tends to add in an extra layer of fees. And if we took a look at that layer of fees, if we wanted to reduce it, we could probably reduce it by getting away from the private equity fund of funds providers and using just a consultant to help us structure it. It tends to be a lower cost solution. Or three is to develop your own fully baked direct approach. And so you'd be actually looking at selecting individual private equity managers and private credit managers. That tends to be the larger plans with larger staff because it's very resource intensive. So at this point, I think Varis probably steps away from this because our San Francisco office does provide private market consulting. And so we don't want to be biased or conflicted in any way. I think this is probably going to be an exercise for staff to review the models and come up with a recommendation for what the board should consider and pros and cons to that.
And that's in the works now. We're anticipating bringing that back to the board relatively soon.
Well, there you go.
Okay, that's item six.
That's item six.
So, Ed, do you need direction on which one of C, B, or C you like to model out in terms of the work on the investment policy statement and others?
I think direction would be helpful. Yes. So when we take a look at A, B, and C,
unless I'm oversimplifying this, it sounds like C gives you close to the return you would have expected with a lower risk profile. So why wouldn't that be relatively self-evident?
I would raise my caution, Mary Flagg. I know Varis is a proponent of risk parity. I'm probably less of a proponent of risk parity. If the board wants to get there, I'm more than happy to put the legwork into that. Bring up our own level of internal working knowledge and due diligence. I would say, I would probably echo the concerns that Gail raised. They are newer. So some of them have been around for 10 years and they've gone through 08, but as a basket, as a fully built out systematic program, a number of kind of a critical mass of managers, I haven't seen the data, so I'm opining here in the absence of data, which is always dangerous. But it is newer, it is less battle-tested than some other strategies. The embedded leverage makes me, leverage is neither good or bad, it just expands range of outcomes.
So does staff have a recommendation on A, B, or C?
I would be biased towards B. I mean, given the fact that we're going to be moving through this on an annual basis to take a look at highest and best use of our growth diversifying dollars, mm-hmm. we can always come back to that. One of my concerns is we've got a lot of moving pieces right now that we've got to get implemented over the course of the remaining of the next year. I think I raised this in December. I probably prefer fewer moving pieces on the front end of this, and we can build into more positions down the road as appropriate.
Okay. I can't make a recommendation, but that sounds intriguing. Hint, hint.
Do we have a motion maker?
I'll move to give direction to pursue option B.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. Moved and seconded that we give direction to Ed to proceed with option B. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Opposed? Jerry, that was an opposition or abstain?
Abstain.
Abstain. Okay. All in favor? I'm sorry.
You did it.
In favor, one abstention.
Okay.
As long as it adds up to nine, John, you're
good. I was working
on it. Everyone just drops hands.
Doing all that in my head is a problem.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, that was direction to staff.
Direction to staff, thank you. The board has given direction to staff, form of Mr. Price, to work with consultant using B as our general model. Thank you. Okay.
Ed, any sense on item 7, how long you think that'll take? We have a working lunch. We could either attempt to complete item 7 before lunch, have quick lunch, or we could attempt to do combine lunch and item 7.
That's kind of like working ahead of a tea time, isn't it?
I think we should do both.
I think we do them simultaneously. Yes. I'm all about
food fight.
Yeah,
multitasking.
Multitasking. Eat and learn at the same time.
It sounds like people are reasonably hungry. All right, let's break, bring lunch back in here, and then begin on item 7 as soon as everybody is able to collect something and bring it back in.
Recording excerpted.